The governor is motivated to make a selection quickly because of the legislative session starting up next week.
Governor Walker names three finalists to fill Dean Westlake's House seat. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the rules for investing billions of permanent fund money in risky startups.
My wife's a psychologist. She'd be really disappointed to hear me say that emotions don't matter, or even that they get in the way, but I think that's the honest reality.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Governor Bill Walker will pick one of three finalists to fill the Alaska House seat left vacant by Dean Westlake, who resigned after he was accused of harassing female aides. Utqiagvik resident Leanna Mack, Kotzebue City Councilwoman Sandy Schroyer Beaver, and Kotzebue Councilman Eugene Smith were nominated by the District 40 Democratic Party. A majority of the 16 Democrats in the House must approve Westlake's replacement. Walker spokesman Austin Baird says the governor's team is vetting each candidate's background.
He's working to line up their travel schedules with his, and he does plan on meeting individually with each of the finalists before he does make a decision.
Walker has until January 24th to make a pick.
The governor is motivated to make a selection quickly because of the legislative session starting up next week. But the key in this process is picking someone whose values and beliefs are actually in line with the residents of House District 40. So if it does take up to the deadline, then that is the reason why.
The session begins on Tuesday. Blink, and you might have missed it. In just 3 weeks, there was a profound shift in the landscape for energy and environment issues in Alaska. There were at least four big developments since December 20th, largely thanks to the Trump administration. In case you didn't catch them all, Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has this review.
Most Alaskans probably know about the biggest news story on the list because it's a doozy.
They tried in Ronald Reagan. They tried with the Bushes. They tried with everybody. They never got ANWR, but we got ANWR in this bill. So we have ANWR. We have mandate.
Item number one. On December 20th, President Donald Trump signed a tax bill into law opening part of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil development. This was a huge win for Alaska's political leaders and a huge loss for environmental groups who fought oil drilling in the refuge for nearly four decades. And while we're on the subject of oil in the Arctic, the Trump administration made another big announcement in the first few days of 2018.
Today we're embarking on a new path for energy dominance in America, particularly on offshore.
That's item number two. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke announced he's putting Arctic waters back on the table as part of the new draft plan for offshore drilling leases. And the plan would also open the door for oil development off pretty much all of Alaska's other coasts, except for Bristol Bay. And speaking of Bristol Bay, that brings us to item number three. In late December, the Pebble Limited Partnership finally submitted a permit application to build a gold and copper mine in southwest Alaska, a hugely controversial project because of its proximity to the Bristol Bay salmon fishery. The Obama administration had pretty much stalled Pebble, but now it's moving forward again. How much have things changed now that Donald Trump is in the White House? Here's Pebble CEO Tom Collier.
I think it's dramatic.
Another part of Alaska feeling the dramatic shift in Washington, D.C. is King Cove. That's the last big news story on our list. Item number four. In the first week of January, the city of King Cove said it reached a deal with the Trump administration to build a road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. All told, the Trump administration is ushering in a historic shift in how Alaska's resources are managed, from the North Slope to Bristol Bay. But most of the decisions aren't final yet, and environmental groups are guaranteed to keep fighting these changes, including in court. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Now for some context on these big policy changes, I'm joined by Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin. Hi, Liz.
Hey, Lori.
Liz, how did this all happen at the same time?
Well, a lot of these things, most of these things, have been percolating for years and years. And after a few months, almost a year of unified Republican control in Washington, you know, that gave time for one more round of incubation. And then, bingo, everything hatches at the end of the year, just when people are getting ready to leave for vacation. Deadlines produce results.
So, Liz, no single factor at work here?
Yeah, that's right. I asked Senator Lisa Murkowski about that. She said, no, it wasn't just one thing, but even she sounded a little stunned by the pace. Here's what she said.
Oh, my goodness. It's like the beginning of the new year, though, and it's kind of nice to know that some of the things that we've been working on for decades, we've made some real progress.
When do you think we'll see action on the ground on these changes?
Oh, it'll take a while. For the Arctic Refuge, the next step is probably updating the government's assessment, you know, the document that says how much oil is there. We could possibly see 3D seismic work done in the refuge this winter, maybe. As for Pebble, they just submitted a permit application so far. It's a big move. It was a long time in coming, but of course the permit would need approval. And in all of these issues, we can probably say that lawsuits are likely.
What's the story with this massive offshore leasing expansion? We've seen in the news some states pushing back. Talk a little about that with us.
All right. Let me first point out that it's a draft proposed program, so like a draft. It is really massive. It is most federal waters and all the planning areas around Alaska except for Bristol Bay. But, you know, we could think of this as kind of a statement, the administration's political statement that all of these areas should be open. And now that that's on the table, they begin the process of winnowing. Both Secretary Zinke and the Alaska senators have said that they are open to hearing about which areas are sensitive and should not be available for leasing. We should also point out that for most of the planning areas around Alaska, there really aren't any assessments showing that there's a great deal of resource potential. So in the end, the lease sales might be limited to the Arctic and Cook Inlet, as we've seen before.
Liz, things have been happening so fast, and how are environmental groups handling what could be seen as a string of defeats?
Yeah, they are feeling beleaguered, attacked on all sides. I think there's also, from some of them, I'm hearing an effort to really pick their battles and not get distracted, not waste their resources on proposals that are likely to fizzle. But yeah, I would say they are feeling exhausted, and they say that their membership has trouble just following what's going on.
All right, Liz, thanks for keeping an eye on these things in Washington for us.
You betcha.
That was Liz Ruskin, Alaska Public Media's Washington, D.C. correspondent. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Sitka Assembly declined to donate to a local cathedral renovation, then city residents stepped in.
As the Assembly continued to discuss it, it was really the best thing that ever happened in our fundraising.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Thinking about completing your college degree? Good news, you can finish it right here at the University of Alaska. Go after your dream by earning a bachelor's, master's, a certificate, or an associate degree at the University of Alaska. Flexible classes, convenient schedules, affordable choices, and outstanding faculty, the university has it all. It's your choice, your dream. See how the University of Alaska can help you achieve it at alaska.edu/start here. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Each year, Alaska's Permanent Fund Corporation invests billions of dollars in private companies and risky startups around the world. It's a relatively new and so far really successful strategy for making money. But how do you pick the next big winner out of a sea of potential companies? In the second of a two-part series, Rasha McChesney from Alaska's Energy Desk walks us through five basic rules of investing at the Permanent Fund.
Stephen Mosley is just your average, fast-talking New York investment banker type of guy. Except he's not in New York anymore. He's 4 hours behind the market in Juneau. I visited his blindingly white office in a building just outside of downtown.
Yo, this is my office here. Please come in.
Okay. Is this a stand-up desk?
It is. That's the best thing.
It's here that he manages $7 billion of the state's sovereign wealth fund. And Mosley agreed to give me a sneak peek into his portfolio. But first, a bit of wrangling.
Do you ever stand when things get really intense in here? Should I invest? Should I not invest?
Well, before I reveal those important secrets, I should ask what the because everybody will copy me, you know.
Portfolio managers, like fishermen, don't like to give away their secrets. They want to show you the big fish they caught. They don't want to tell you where or how they caught it. With $7 billion in his back pocket and an eye for risk, you might think it would be a little easier to talk him into investing in your project.
Okay, check it out. I want to use drones to deliver tacos so that people don't even have to leave their high-rise apartments to come down to the street to get a taco. I can just deliver it to them. What's your first thought?
Well, first I'd need tacos in my hand to think that through.
Okay, so I'll bring tacos to our first meeting.
No. I think there are rules, actually, that would prevent me from enjoying the tacos.
So, rule one, no bribes.
I can't bring you a taco bribe to sell you my taco investment?
Sorry, we can get tacos some other day, but no, it doesn't sell taco investments. There's a lot of cool technology out there in the world, more than I've seen, and much of it will never be realized and profitable. We've got to think about it first as investors.
So rule two, it can't just be an interesting gadget. I'm looking at you, Google Glass. It's got to have staying power.
So the emotional reaction has no value. There's even sort of a cost to it.
Rule three, don't let your emotions get in the way.
My wife's a psychologist. She'd be really disappointed to hear me say that emotions don't matter or even that they get in the way. But I think that's the honest reality.
Okay. So my idea for taco drones is a dud. But really, it should be. It doesn't meet any of the markers fund managers are looking for in a good investment idea. And while it's hard to pinpoint exactly what good means to Mosley, his team's portfolio has some big success stories, and it has made more than $1 billion for the fund. I asked Mosley's boss, Permanent Fund CEO Angela Rodell, what exactly her team is looking for in an investment idea. She says, right out of the gate, the idea has to be big enough to make a difference in a $63 billion fund. So, rule four. Any investment needs to be $25 million or more.
That's the low bar. I mean,
so that's pretty basic. But the next hurdles start to sound a lot like fund managers looking for those fishing holes we were talking about earlier.
They're rapidly scalable.
Is the idea in an innovative technology sector, an emerging market? What's the political situation? How's the regulatory environment? Fund managers are eyeing global growth. Rodell says they're looking for projects in places they're expecting to gain a lot of value in the next few years.
They are in China, India, Africa, South America.
Most of these rules are unwritten. One investor told me that as soon as you come up with some hard and fast rules for investing, some good idea or project comes along that breaks all of them. Among those unwritten rules, there's one that's kind of elusive. And that's because it really isn't one that the Permanent Fund Corporation came up with. It's more of a house rule. And that house rule is something that a lot of state-owned funds deal with. I call it, at a state-owned corporation, the legislature reigns supreme. But that's a working title. What it means is that when this state struggles to pay its bills, lawmakers start eyeing the Permanent Fund. Right now, Alaska has a $2.5 billion hole in its budget, and it isn't likely to be filled anytime soon. The legislature has already used most of its savings to cover that gap for the last few years, so there has been a lot of talk of tapping into the Permanent Fund's investment earnings. Right now, the Permanent Fund's investment strategy is to invest in things with long-term returns. 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. It's spread out across stocks and bonds and real estate and public and private investments. That kind of diversity is designed to limit loss, but it isn't designed to be a short-term piggy bank. So what would the corporation do if the legislature came looking for quick cash?
Easy thing to do is to sell stocks. It's very liquid, or sell bonds.
Rodell says the possibility that the corporation could need to come up with billions in cash, it fundamentally changes how and what fund managers can invest in. It's something that she has to keep in the back of her mind when the corporation is considering new investments and new strategies. There is one last rule, and it's one that Rodell says can be the hardest for fund managers to follow. Rule number 5 is the rule of the gambler. You got to know when to hold 'em. Rodell says there are two types of selling. The first is when an investment has made all of the money it can for the fund. And the second, well, that's the one that Rodell says can be the hardest for fund managers to deal with. And it's part of her job to let them know.
This thing is a dog and it needs to go.
When an investment tanks, an investor has to know when to cut their losses and walk away. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
All 3 of the Sam's Club stores in Alaska are closing this month as the national big box retail chain shutters dozens of its outlets across the country. At the Fairbanks Sam's Club, which is the only bulk wholesaler of its kind in the city, there was only a sign on the front door saying the store was closed today, and none of its employees could be reached for comment. Shoppers who showed up at the Fairbanks store this morning expressed surprise and disappointment.
We buy a lot of stuff here. This is going to hurt to have it gone, so I don't know exactly what their rationale was for closing this store.
Patty Bohannon says she regularly shops at Sam's for both business and home.
They've had some of the best prices in town for a lot of stuff, so our bills are going to be going up.
Because there's not even a Costco or anything. It's one of the major, you know, I mean, even restaurants around here, they come here to Sam's Club and buy bulk.
Nicole Lombardi and Birch Martin also showed up at Fairbanks Sam's Club to find the doors locked.
It was inconvenient, I guess you could say.
Sam's is a really cool place to shop. You save money, get bulk.
Alaska Sam's Club stores, which include one in Fairbanks and 2 in Anchorage, will reopen Friday for 2 weeks before closing for good. Lower 48 news reports say other stores are also scheduled to close. There's no information about closures on the Sam's Club or parent company Walmart websites, and requests for comment from officials with both companies went unanswered. Sam's Club officials did tweet a reply to questions about stores closing that said, quote, "After a thorough review of our existing portfolio, we've decided to close a series of clubs and better align our locations with our strategy," end quote. According to the Sam's Club website, the membership warehouse operates 650 stores in the United States and Puerto Rico with 100,000 employees. The state is preparing for the final season of its largest and longest-running predator control program. The Upper Yukon Tanana Aerial Wolf Kill has harvested about 1,000 wolves from the calving grounds of the 40-mile caribou herd since 2004. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the controversial aerial shooting program is scheduled to sunset this spring so biologists can evaluate its effectiveness.
The state plans to kill about 70 wolves on the 40-mile caribou calving grounds later this winter in the final season of the 14-year program.
It's time to evaluate the effects of high-intensity wolf control.
Department of Fish and Game Interior Regional Supervisor Darren Bruning says this winter will be the 7th season since the aerial wolf kill was intensified to try to better benefit 40-mile caribou, and that after this spring, the program will sunset for up to 5 years.
The suspension will allow us to evaluate 40-mile caribou survival without control efforts.
In 2016, the state and public killed 167 wolves in the sprawling control area. A computer model estimates could be home to around 450 wolves. The caribou herd was thought to have stagnated at about 50,000 until this past fall, when a new estimate conducted with better digital photography upped it to over 70,000 animals. Berning says the pause in wolf control is aimed at sorting out what's going on in the ecosystem.
Should provide information on how predation influences that population of caribou.
The vagaries of weather, unmeasured variables, are always going to present an element of uncertainty that you just can't get unless you're in a laboratory.
State Division of Wildlife Conservation Director Bruce Dale emphasizes that field science is getting better.
Previous evaluations were limited to available population estimation data. Now we have better data, so that's going to inform it. Now we have increased our efforts in terms of evaluating the nutritional status relative to the forage resources, and so we'll have better information. And we'll finish a very important component, which is the third year of a calf mortality study to evaluate survival and how that's responded to the wolf reductions.
Dale acknowledges that some Alaskans oppose predator control programs.
We realize they're controversial.
I think there's absolutely no justification for them continuing this Upper Yukon Tanana 40-mile wolf control program another year.
Biologist and wildlife advocate Rick Steiner maintains wolf control does not work and is ethically opposed to it, especially the use of radio or GPS-collared wolves to locate and kill entire family groups.
The Judas wolf collaring methodology is particularly unethical and egregious and barbaric to many people, and they've killed 60 or 70 wolves in the area there using this radio collaring, Judas collaring technique in the last 5 or 6 years.
Steiner and numerous others have repeatedly petitioned Governor Walker's administration to halt the 40-mile wolf kill and other state predator control programs. Steiner has also sought photo or video evidence of the state wolf kill operation, documentation the state says it doesn't have. Steiner says the state has agreed to participate in a National Academy of Sciences review of its predator control programs. The last such review was conducted 20 years ago when Governor Tony Knowles halted lethal control efforts. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Congressman Don Young has a challenger in this year's midterm elections. At an event this evening in Anchorage, Elise Galvin announced her bid for Alaska's single seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. A release from her campaign introduces Galvin as a mother, a leader, and a fighter for working families in Alaska. Her career has focused largely on education, working for years as a teacher, and more recently, Galvin founded the public education coalition called Great Alaska Schools. It was through that coalition that Galvin spoke out against the nomination of Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education for the Trump administration. Along with continuing to advocate for public education, Galvin's campaign announcement says she'll focus on health care, the economy, and the opioid epidemic. Galvin will run as an independent candidate and appear on the Democratic primary ballot in August. Congressman Don Young is the longest-serving member of the U.S. House of Representatives, holding the seat since 1973. An historic landmark in the center of downtown Sitka was the subject of fierce debate at the Assembly 2 weeks ago over the separation of church and state. While the Assembly ultimately decided not to donate to renovation work at St. Michael's Orthodox Cathedral, a local citizen put forward the cash, and many more have followed. KCAW's Emily Kwong reports.
St. Michael's Cathedral is smack dab in the middle of downtown, built in the 19th century when Alaska was under the control of Russia. It's undergoing massive renovation work, and shortly after the Assembly narrowly rejected a proposal to donate $5,000 from the Visitors Enhancement Fund, an anonymous donor wrote a check for that same amount. The Sitka Sentinel reported the donor left a written statement in which he said, "We Sitkans see this every time we are downtown. I would be happy to make that contribution. How about you?" Turns out, many Sitkans agreed. Anna Dittmar is leading the construction project.
As the assembly continued to discuss it, it was really the best thing that ever happened in our fundraising, because we continued to get donations from private individuals here in Sitka.
Since the assembly took up the issue, citizens have made $50,000 in private donations to St. Michael's, and a local citizen has pledged $40,000 this spring. If that sounds like a big figure, keep in mind the bills for restoration work are big too. The exterior paint job on the bottom half of the building costs $135,000 alone, and possibly more if additional work is needed. Dittmar says they've contracted with Pete Hagen of KD Painting for the intensive work, which will continue in the spring when the weather improves and the cruise ships are in town.
And that's helpful with fundraising too. In fact, the first check that we got from a cruise ship visitor that was of any substance last summer was a young man who came in. We never saw him before. We never saw him after that. He just wrote out a check for $1,000.
When asked what compels people to dip into their pockets upon entering St. Michael's, Dittmar simply says, "You can feel the history when you step inside."
Some of the cruise ship visitors cry. They come into the building and they're so taken that they just sit down and tears come to their eyes. There are a lot of people who are very moved. I mean, there are other people who can't get out fast enough. I'm not trying to say that everybody that step in and you'll start crying, but there are a lot of people that have an emotional experience.
St. Michael's Cathedral is a National Historic Landmark and one of Alaska's most endangered properties. The original structure burned to the ground in 1966 and was reconstructed shortly after. Moving forward, the cathedral is also in dire need of a new roof. Eventually, the rotted front steps will need to be replaced and inspection work done on the spire. As far as the dome, Dittmar says the leaking has diminished. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Finally tonight, a correction. In a story we aired on Tuesday about how cuts at the Department of Law are affecting caseloads, we reported that certain divisions had lost 22% of their staff. In fact, it was the department's overall budget that declined by 22%. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Elizabeth Harbaugh and Emily Russell in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Emily Kwong in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. You can nominate your favorite teacher at bpteachers.com. The deadline is February 1st. The Federal Subsistence Board is accepting applications through February 2nd to fill seats on the 10 Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. Councils meet at least twice a year and provide critical advice to the board on subsistence management issues. Individuals may apply or nominate someone for membership. More at doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456. This message is sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.